Are you registered to vote? Headcount is a nonpartisan organization that works with the music and entertainment industry to get fans to vote. To update or check your voter registration status, go to headcount.org, where you'll find all the information you need to be ready for Election Day.
Headcount tours with musicians to help concert attendees register to vote, but you don't need to leave your house to register or to get voting info. Register to vote by visiting headcount.org. Hello, and welcome to another episode of
Mixtape Memories.
I'm Matt Hart-Spade.
And I'm Jenners. And we have a great guest today. You're in for a treat. Matt Rodbard, who is the founding editor of Taste, New York Times bestselling author. We're going to be talking about some food memories. Food music memories? I don't know. Is that how you say it? Talking about, like, I guess mostly the aughts, but I have some 90s memories. Yeah, just kind of like how it was back then, running around New York, going to shows, and then, you know, inevitably eating food at all hours.
Well, thanks for having me on the podcast. I'm a huge fan of it. It takes me back. It's like blast from the past every episode. There's like voices I knew back in the day, and just keep doing it. I hope it goes forever, guys.
Aww,
just love
thanks.
It.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Been like a food journalist for a while now, and you know, now you have the cooking magazine Taste, and like, yeah. How did that all get started for you, your love of food?
So how did it happen, like food and music? I mean, I was fortunate that I lived in the East Village in the Niagara building at the corner of 7th and A from 02 to 05.
Nice.
I moved there from college, and I started as a music writer. First and foremost, I worked at Spin Magazine as an intern and worked at MTV News with that whole crew.
Yeah.
Starting in 03. But so I got to, and I wrote for all sorts of places, zines, print. I had my own zine 2040. And so I music was really my love and my passion. And it still is obviously today, but food is definitely more of my job and my passion. So that, but I really was fortunate, and we can talk a little bit about how it segued around 2011 full-time from music to food.
I feel like they went so hand-in-hand, particularly back in the day, because like Jin was mentioning, it was kind of one of those things, if the gig is from, you know, 8 to midnight, you got to eat something quick before, and then afterwards you're hungry. So yeah. You're kind of constantly running around to these spots, and in a lot of cases they're like kind of quick experiences, like the quick taco or the quick pizza, mm-hmm. or you get a drink here and whatnot. What were some of your favorite places back in the day?
Well, I mean, in the East Village, you know, we were living it up. I mean, we had, you know, lots of places that were single operator, like single restaurants. Remember, this is a time, it's before Seamless. There's no real iPhones, obviously. You talk about that a lot on the podcast about this pre-iPhone. So you're really having to dial up, walk down to the restaurant, pick up your food, or just dine in. I mean, where do you want to start? I mean, for me, one restaurant I really wanted to call out was Bao 111, which maybe isn't familiar to all your listeners, but this was such an influential restaurant from Michael Bao Nguyen at the corner of 7th and C. And it was one of the first Vietnamese restaurants to ever get a New York Times star. And, you know, it wasn't really a quick takeout pre-show kind of place, but the way Michael was doing noodles and just really making Vietnamese food for the masses in 2002, it's like he was like light years ahead of his time. And I just really want to, that's where we can like play ping pong all day with this, because let's do it.
Well, I think between the three of us we have a lot of memories.
We
definitely will ping pong a bit, but 7th and C is a good starting spot, I think.
Yeah absolutely.
And it wasn't too far from you if you were by 7A.
No, and you know, look at 7A, like you walk up the street, you're at Odessa. You're at Odessa Bar, which Odessa Bar was where I had my first drink underage at 19, 1999. Yeah, I mean, did you guys go to, I know like Allen Ginsberg was hanging out at Odessa, you know, it was, did you guys ever go there?
Oh yeah, like just late night really. I never went there like for proper like dinner or lunch or anything like that, but it was always like late night.
Yeah, I loved Odessa. I mean, I think like they were recently in, there was like talk of them possibly going under, but it seems like that was just a rumor, thankfully.
Well, I went there a few weeks ago during quarantine to pay respects because I did hear that news as well. But I've come to find out Gothamist reported that it is not closing. So thankfully.
Yeah.
Yeah, apparently they're just renovating or something. Who knows?
Who knows?
People got scared and started the whole got rumor train.
Yeah, yeah. Well,
that's the big trend right now is like what place, nostalgic places closing because of the pandemic, you know?
Yeah.
Like, I just heard Snackies is closing in Williamsburg, which is like, I had so many memories in the beginning of Snackies, like hanging out when it first opened. But then I stopped hanging out there because I felt like it was like where indie rock dudes pick up Asian girls.
Whoa, yeah.
I love how you went right into it. There's, I know, like, no mystery. It's like that's what it was for.
Can we talk about San Loco then?
Yes.
Let's talk about indie rock dudes picking up everyone. Whoa! All right, I gotta ask you guys: are you
San Loco? I have a lot of memories, so yeah, go ahead.
Pro or con? Like for me, I lived on the Macho Nacho during that period. Ate that too much. I remember Lady Gaga's boyfriend, Luke, I think his name is, worked there. That was like a little thing that I remember making jokes about. But I just want to say, I went there recently to dine, and the food has fallen off. Or, let me ask you this, it's fallen off, or did I just not know really what was going on?
I think it was always bad, right? Like,
I think it was always bad.
It was always so
I always
bad.
Got a stomachache afterwards.
Like, oh my gosh.
I just didn't think things were very flavorful. But you know what's funny? I haven't thought of the Macho Nachos in quite some time, but that's exactly what I would order also.
Such a good deal. It was $5.
It was a good deal.
It was a lot of food for $5. Now, obviously, that was important.
Yeah, it never really, like, I mean, I was there a lot just because all the venues were around the corner, obviously, pianos and living room and everything else.
Yep.
And cake shop.
Oh, man.
But Arlene's actually didn't go to a bunch. But yeah, San Loco was never my favorite food, but it was convenient and it was inexpensive.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
What about Marshall Stack? Did you ever eat there?
I don't remember that place.
No, I always thought the sandwiches were really good there. The food was excellent, and it was right around the corner from Bowery Ballroom. So that, I guess that's one of my memories, is Marshall Stack was always good for a decent bite when San Loco was obviously not really good for it. And I agree with you, it's not flavorful. That stuff is not. They need more sauce.
Marshall Stack I remember going to, but also like after Bowery shows, and it was I was already a couple drinks in at that point.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
Going back to San Loco, I remember interviewing the Joy Formidable there after a gig at Pianos. I dug up the interview on YouTube. It's kind of funny because, like, my questions are so not exciting at all. But I think back in the day, like, before I understood nuance and before I understood how to not ask the obvious question, it was just how it was, you know. But it was a nice spot because you could just get a little booth and, you know, no one would really bother you.
Speaking of interviewing bands, I interviewed Franz Ferdinand at Cafe Colonial, which was on Houston. Do you remember that place? It was like a Brazilian style. It was on like the south side of Houston.
Yeah.
And I remember Chloe Walsh had set it up. She was at Press Here at the time. And I remember going in, and this band was just at the moment getting big, and I did it for like Big Takeover. Or no, not one of the zines. And it was weird to do that type of interview because that wasn't really my thing to do, like the afternoon band in town interview. And I remember we talked about the band Orange Juice a lot, and then I think I ordered Orange Juice to be clever. And you know, that's what you do when you're like 22 trying to interview bands and trying
to
do something funny. Ugh.
Did they pick up on that?
Yeah, they're really Alex is incredibly fast and sharp and just one of the greater minds in rock. And yeah, he did. He went along with it. He was very polite and for my bad joke. But we talked a lot about Scottish pop. That's what we talked about. Yeah.
I once, and I know I talked about it in a previous episode, but like I once saw the Cribs at Bowery Ballroom, and afterwards I met Johnny Marr, and all I wanted to do was like BS with him and buy him a drink. And he also wanted orange juice. Because he doesn't drink.
Yeah. Whoa, that's a good one.
That was a good one. I pretty much like passed out afterwards.
So. Yeah. Jinners, what's your What's your band interview restaurant story? You gotta have one.
Oh, geez. At a restaurant.
You gotta have one.
Well, you must have done one at Pianos, no?
I did. I did. The only one I remember is C. Ray. I interviewed Jeff Scheinkoff from C. Ray mm-hmm. there. And I still have the tape, actually, the little micro cassette.
Oh, yeah. Got a box of those. Big,
yeah.
And I don't know what he does anymore, but I follow him on Instagram. And he always has these, like, amazing, like, landscape photos, like all these exotic places. He must do something where he just works remotely and gets to travel like, to really amazing Sweet. Places.
I have a Pianos question. So I think I went on the first night, and then can we talk about piano smell for a second?
Yes, because I can smell it just when you mention it.
You know, like I went the first night or whatever, and it was like a smell. I'm like, okay, that's like new bar smell. But then like 12 years later, it still had that smell. What's up with that?
What was the smell? I don't remember the smell.
I've been thinking about this. It was like slightly cleaner. It was like kind of in the range of Pine Sol, like kind of Windex-y smell. It wasn't like a warm food smell. It was like something very synthetic. Yeah. And it was like, but it was so unique that clearly it was the piano smell.
I agree with you, but I also would probably add in that it was like as if someone poured a beer on a carpet every day for 14 years. And then like that mildewy kind of stink mixed with the Pine Sol.
Gross.
Oh my gosh.
How do I not know this smell? I also have a bad sense of smell, so maybe that's it.
Yeah.
I know, and I was there last year too. I went for New Colossus or whatever. So it wasn't that long ago for me.
Yeah.
But I mean, I used to be there all the friggin' time, like at least once a week.
Yes.
Oh, yeah. Back in the day. Mm-hmm. That stage was high, and it made sense in a lot for a lot of bands. I thought it was a nice stage.
Mm-hmm. I feel like so many of these food memories, too, are, like, based in the Lower East Side, especially mm-hmm. in the aughts, just because that's where all the venues were, and they were all close together, so you could, like, bounce from show to show, grab a bite here and there on your way, and then, like, you know, go to the bar. Yeah, there were so many bars too.
I mean, I think we were talking earlier about the Magician.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
I feel the Magician, and then Welcome to the Johnson to some extent.
Right.
But I feel the Magician, and to this day, it's still open. I walked by recently, and they're still doing quarantine style, but cash only. What a jukebox! What a the tile clean bar! What an amazing place! I just have to say that.
Yeah.
Magician was one of my spots, and notably for that jukebox. I just remember, like, I would go in at, like, happy hour and then put $10 in the jukebox and just play every Smiths album. Mm. And then anyone who would come in, as it would get more crowded, would just have to deal with the Smiths for 3 hours. That was, my
Love
little
that. Thing.
Yeah. No, but I liked it. They had, like, a 2-for-1 happy hour, and it was, I don't know, it was it was always fine for me. And also, it was right off the F train, which was perfect for when I was living off the F train.
100% agree. And I know, so then there's Schiller's, which less fond memories.
Yes. I feel like that was just, like, located in the right spot, because, like, in the way, way, way east, Lower East Side, you would have, like, Shanae and Rothko, and then, like, in the East Village-y kind of Lower East Side, it was like Mercury Lounge. So if you were bouncing between shows or you're just in that area, like, that place was open. But it was like not a great scene.
Fully agree. And those Keith McNally restaurants are closing quickly, and I just am not a huge fan of them. I thought that they were just artifice and artificially, like, artificial sense of cool, and just didn't have the soul of a lot of places that I think we're going to talk about more. And you know, fucking douchebags. I mean, seriously.
Yeah, yes. I feel the same. Yeah. I feel the same. I mean, I do. Yeah, I mean, I don't actually remember the food. I just remember it being very crowded, and everyone in that place was just like someone I didn't really want to talk to.
Yeah.
It, like, I think it was trying to be, like, you know, like, those fancy restaurants in the meatpacking district.
Yes.
You know, it kind of had that vibe.
Yeah. I mean, heading up the road, I'd like to talk about Kate's Joint for a second?
Yeah.
Did you, were you fans of Kate's Joint?
I mean, I went there a couple times. I mean, I have good memories, no specific, you know, memories.
I feel like it was always with my vegan or vegetarian friends.
Yeah. I always found that place, the food was always like pretty good, but honestly, it was where you took your out of town vegetarian friends. But, you know, clearly a cool vibe and like really interesting service, and always it was a female owned restaurant. Mm-hmm. And CMJ weekends, those weekends in October, I just recall that place being awesome, like being where the bands, you'd see vans around it, and it feeling like a real sense of community in the East Village.
Yeah.
And I think I went there maybe when I was in college too, but like really, I thought that that was like one of those places that could never exist in New York today. Mm. Just because it's like a single restaurant, single operator, and like it's not a chain. There's no real angle for it to be great for takeout or for seamless. This is all pre-seamless. So it makes me sad because I think the New York dining scene has changed so dramatically away from the styles of restaurants because of real estate. And I think of Kate's a lot because Kate's Joint, because it's just, it was a special place and it was beyond the food. And now we just don't have them anymore. So.
It's true. A lot of places are kind of falling by the wayside. You always hear about them. Did you guys like go to Great Jones Cafe a lot back in the day?
Yeah.
yeah.
No, just because like I always, for some reason, when I think of Great Jones Cafe, I think of a certain vibe that I don't necessarily like. And I don't know if it's because maybe back in the day. Like,
interesting.
Yeah.
Oh.
You didn't like
Are
the
you
vibe?
Not a Pavement fan?
I don't know. No, I like Pavement. It has nothing to do with that. I don't know. I just got a vibe when I walked in there I didn't necessarily love. And I can't define what it is. I don't know.
Mark Eibald worked there all the time. Like, he was behind the bar.
Yeah.
And really nice guy. I mean, just would serve you the shandy or whatever, that ginger and rum drink. They had a light and a dark. Awesome drink. New Orleans food. So it was like this cool New Orleans restaurant. And Matt, I think I get a sense, maybe it's the, was it the, like, weird decor? Like, it felt like a little, like, out of place for New York. It just, maybe that was it. I'm trying to like articulate what you're saying.
You know what it might be? It might be that you know, it's kind of one of those things I sort of blocked out, but it might be that the people I went with the few times I was there, mm-hmm. I no longer speak to, and therefore I have the attachment. You know what it is? It's more the people maybe, and not the place itself. The mm-hmm. place was the unfortunate middle person here.
That happens. And then across the street, Acme Underground.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Just a really great venue. And I remember seeing the Polyvinyl showcase at CMJ there back in like 2004. And I stand hard for Polyvinyl Records. Just mm-hmm. got a shout out on a music podcast. My love for that label. And, you know, some like Raina Maria, my buddies at Paris, Texas, like back, all those bands that defined Midwestern emo from the late 90s into the early 2000s. Just some of my favorite. Aloha was on that mm-hmm. label. Love that band. So. Just remember those shows in the basement were really good.
Yeah, I was a big fan of Aloha, and more so Raina Maria, who Jin and I actually saw a few years ago.
No way.
Yeah, they were back. So.
Wait, oh
yeah,
man.
Was that at Elsewhere?
It was at Elsewhere, yeah.
Cool show.
Yeah.
Oh, I would have gone to that.
Great Jones, I have felt like, you know, they were always like connected to the music scene, because like I think people would go there a lot after mm-hmm. shows or before shows, or they'd have dinner there. I mean, mm-hmm. their food was like so good, and like,
oh man,
they had really good drinks. And then like one of my friends and I, who are like big Pavement fans, our favorite thing to do is like randomly go there when Mark Eibald was like bartending, and like sit at the bar and like pretend we didn't know who he was.
Oh my gosh.
Did he catch on?
No, I don't think so.
No. Okay.
But like, yeah. It was just like this like quiet thrill.
I mean that's a single bartender kind of setup. The guy's working. He's like expediting food from the back.
Yeah.
So like, it's not just some vanity bullshit. Like that dude was putting in the reps.
Yeah.
Like, mm-hmm. I tried not to acknowledge him as well. I played that game in my own way. It's yeah. hard not to, though.
And they had a great jukebox there, know, so I just think, and that was like kind of like the first thing to go when they were like like first announced that they were closing?
I think Gabe Stuhlman might have bought it. Gabe Stuhlman owns a bunch of restaurants in the city. He's a restaurateur. He's from Wisconsin, and we went to college together. Really good guy. He, I think, took it back over, and then pandemic happened, and so I think it stalled out. But I believe it will be reopening under new management.
Interesting.
So yeah, but still never going to be the spirit of what it was before.
Yeah, there was more of a punk rock spirit to it. But I mean, like, I first went there not like through the music scene, but when I was like a freshman in college, and like some, you know, guy took me to brunch there, and I like had my first like Bloody Mary. I didn't even know what Bloody Marys were before then. I was such a dummy. And I was just like, you know, I hadn't been exposed to a lot of things. So like, you know, being in New York, I was just learning so much about like everything, just because everything is here. So that was like my first kind of Great Jones like cafe memory. And then like later on after college, I think I got back into it because, you know, people would have like after parties there or like meet up there all the time. So
it's a really cool thought about food in New York as a young person. Like, I moved here in 02 when I was in my 20s, or interned here in my 20s, and I had not been exposed to a lot of food. And I think it's a common refrain when you move to New York, especially now, or back in the day, you know, you were having your first Korean food, which I had it on 32nd Street, and I fell in love with it. It's amazing food. And you're having your first dim sum, you're having your, maybe even your first taco truck. And New York is wonderful for that. It really is a city where if you have only a few bucks, you can get, still to this day, wonderful food and be introduced to the world of food, the global cuisine. And like, I think that's what got me into food, was just by circumstance of living here, I was able to experience all sorts of different cuisine and to start writing about it. And it was really easy. If I had not lived in New York, it would have been much more difficult to establish this kind of base. So I think in this period we're talking about, there was even more of these restaurants that had like specific cuisine and just were really, I think like Robert Seitzema wrote about it in the Village Voice, and I would go to those restaurants and like, wow, there's like such a world here.
Also back then, I drank a lot more than I hardly drink anymore, but like you needed food to like soak up all the alcohol.
Very true.
And like continue partying. So
did we drink more in the early 2000s than like the people in their early 20s drink now?
Yeah, I think because now everyone is vaping and whatnot and edibles and stuff. And for me, it was always a drink. Well, at least it was at that point, you know? So, yeah, I think so. I mean, I just remember having, like, way too many gin and tonics and waking up with, like, that terrible pounding headache.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't miss that.
It was always marketed to us, too. I mean, like, I was, you know, back in, like, editorial, it's like, and you're, like, you know, talking to like Cornerstone or something, like a marketing company, like, and they're like, we have Red Stripe, and like, let's sponsor your party with some free Red Stripe. And so like,
I mean, Sparks back in like 2004, like those Sparks open bars,
oh my god,
Red Stripe open bars, Modelo open bars, like all those weird vodka brands. I feel like it was very, it flowed, like Lit obviously had an open bar literally every night for some random brand.
Yeah.
And I wonder, like, we were kind of in our cups a bit as kids then, and it feels like maybe now the kids who are into music, I hate using that word, but I'm just being specific, are like maybe not in their cups as much with the music scene, and maybe they're processing this great music that's happening in a different way than being totally wasted at shows, which felt like that was the refrain from most of my friends in the industry and in just New Yorkers.
They're experiencing it through their iPhones.
Yeah.
They're too busy. Like,
oh, you're right.
And it's true. It's a very different experience.
Maybe they took an edible before.
Yeah. I think of like Cine. Like, I think of the drink specials at Cine. Yeah. And like just being at these shows that, you know, Stevie and the Radio at Cine. Like, my God, what a memory. But then I'm thinking, did I drink too much of that show to even like really love it? And I'm like, yeah, I lost my camera that night, it sucked. I drank too much, and like, I just, the music was so good, and like, I don't know, I'm sorry this is diverging into like alcohol, but I feel like it maybe skewed some of my own personal thoughts about the time and the music that was happening.
Yeah, for me personally, it was what I always call like a second adolescence, where like, you know, all the things that I didn't experience growing up like with a strict childhood, I got to do. And so I felt like, even though I was in my 20s, that I was like hanging out with the cool kids in high school. That's kind of how it was. And that's how the music scene is. I mean, like,
yeah,
it's very loose and party oriented and like very social. You know, there's always like a promotional party going on or a show or, you know, some dance party or some event that was always going on, and you were always like bouncing from one to another.
Like, I missed, I used to DJ at like Motor City quite a bit, yeah, and Filter 14 and up in Brooklyn at some spots, and like I missed that, and I wish there was a way to do that now where music could be played in bars and it be cool and accessible. Mm-hmm. I don't know if that's happening right now. And obviously dance parties were such a part of that era.
Yeah.
And I don't know if that's happening. I think the music scene has obviously changed and dance music is different. And it's great. There's some incredible dance music that people dance to right now. But like, that was such a social element, like going to DJ nights. That was like rock DJ nights.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
I remember getting so excited to see Stephen Merritt DJ or Paul Banks from Interpol DJ at Beauty Bar. Like that, I would get like, totally. I would get so excited, or Andy Rourke from The Smiths, and just like stare at them the whole night. Yeah. But no, it doesn't, I feel like you don't get that as much these days.
I think that's particular to that time period, though, because, I mean, around that time, I was also working at ASCAP, which is like a music performing rights organization, and I think it just happened that it was a great timing for me, because I was becoming more and more part of, like, the indie rock scene, and that was what was becoming popular in music, and that's what, like, media was paying attention to at that time. And so it was their focus too, because they go with like who is earning money. And so it just like was like a weird coincidence.
What a cool job. Must have been great to be able to cross over your pro life and your nightlife. And
it was an interesting transition, because like before that I was in teen media, which was like not my favorite, but it was a job. And then like got to work there and actually like interview like real people, you know, real like songwriters I respect and stuff like that. Like I was also like just friends with all the membership people, so like when they were signing bands or looking for bands to sign, I could like connect them, and it was fun. You know, it was like a little club back then, you know.
And Matt, we both DJ'd at Angels and Kings.
That is true.
Oh my gosh! What is your memory?
Pete Wentz was the owner or part owner or what? What was the deal?
I know the deal. My friend Scott Nagelberg works at Crush Management, and so it was like a bunch of the Crush Management folks. So it was like Pete Wentz and some of those other bands. And I really enjoyed DJing there, because the booth was in a very good spot. I would say you could definitely see it was elevated and it was central, and you could see what was going on. It was a small booth, and that bar, like that was a club, that was truly a clubhouse, right? I mean, they would close certain nights.
Yeah. I just remember I hosted like deemed a blogger's delight, but what it wound up being was like a, awesome. Like a singles party. Ooh. And everybody got trashed. And I just remember like pretty much I looked around at one point, everybody was making out with someone. I was like, oh, I guess it was a good party. But I don't remember much of it. And I think that kind of ties into what you were saying earlier. It's just like, because so much of the booze and the partying and seeing the bands was so hand in hand, some memories are more blurred than others.
I know. I mean, my CB's memories too. Like, I wish I still had those, but I don't. And I mean, I have a few shows like Ted Leo. I have like another, like a Wax Wings Brendan Benson show. But I think about, like, I wish I could go back to those spots the way that I could go back to places like a decade ago, that like restaurants that I've written about. And I've stopped drinking myself, and like I think it's better for memory and just health in general. But like, I just, it's nice to reflect on this period as it being very fun, but like I'm a little like on the fence about like what were we doing to our bodies at that time to like not fully comprehend them now. I don't know.
Oh yeah, I mean, it's when you're young and having fun, you don't think about stuff like that, like the future and like you know, your health, and because you just think you're invincible, and you know, like you could deal with the hangover, you know, the next day. But I think, yeah, I mean, for me personally, I drink less, although I guess during pandemic it's like risen a little bit, but like you know, typically when I'm at a bar, I don't always have a drink, even. Like, it's just mm-hmm. like not my thing too much anymore, and I just can't imagine getting like that wasted. You know, I used to get so wasted that like I would like throw up and then like catch like a second wind.
Oh my god.
Yep.
And that certainly wasn't healthy.
So. Yeah. Hey. Yeah. Do you guys have CB's memories though? Like, I just like, I've been talking to friends about that era. I mean, the end of CB's, essentially the early 2000s.
CBGB's?
Like, yeah.
My last memory was like Sonic Youth when they did their release show there for what was that album? I don't even remember. Yeah. But they had like an album release show. I think Mark Eibold was playing that show, actually.
Yeah. I mean, for me, definitely those Ted Leo show. I think that was probably one of the better Ted Leo shows I saw. I think he was particularly inspired to play that stage. And Ted Leo is an artist of that era. I mean, Hearts of Oak is like such an album of the era for me. And when we were talking about the repeat skip, I was thinking maybe Hearts of Oak, but like, I think it just really captured the spirit of that era, like that album and him. But I, you know, I don't remember too many other. I saw like Gym Class Heroes there, like for a showcase. Yeah, I know there's other shows, but man, I just wish I had more memory there at that time. How about you, Matt?
Yeah, me too. I mean, I only saw a handful of shows at CB's. I agree with what you said about Ted Leo, just and that album in particular, kind of soundtracking this time. The band that I remember the most from CB's was when I saw Thursday. I was really into like screamo stuff in the early 2000s for a hot minute. Mm-hmm. And I had never seen Thursday properly. I saw them do an acoustic set at the Apple Store the day before. And I guess they were in town to do all these promo type gigs that were, you know, underplays in rooms that are much smaller than they, you know, they typically play. And they played CB's, and it was like somehow I got on the list. And that show, like, it was like all dudes that just wanted to like push each other around, and I was just there for the music, and I was like, oh shit, I'm gonna die at this show. It was very scary because it really was as if I were at a punk show in the 80s or something, and it was like, oh my god, I have to go to the sides of the room here and be that old fart. And at the time I was like, I don't know, 23, 24, but I already felt like the oldest person in the room, you know.
Oh wow.
Wow. I think I saw Super Furry Animals there. One more came back to mind, and that's a band that I got to see at that period a lot. And, you know, I think we share a love for Britpop as well.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. When I first, like, came to New York, I was working for, like, the college newspaper, and our first assignment was me and my roommate, who was also, like, a journalism major, basically got assigned, like, is punk rock dead? That was our assignment. And we had to, like, go out and write an article about this. And, like, I'll tell you, like, I didn't know anything about punk rock, so I was just like, okay, cool. Like, we're going to go to, like, 8th Street and, like, just, you know, walk down St. Mark's and, like, interview people who look like punk rockers. And
cool,
we would just walk up to them and be like, what do you think? Do you think punk rock is dead? And, like, whatever. Like, get their answers. And it was, like, the most awkward, like, thing ever. And then we wandered into CBGB's. And Hilly Crystal was sitting right there in the front. Mm-hmm.
Always at the front.
We're like, hey, can we like interview you about the death of punk rock? And I think we were there for like quite a while, like at least an hour when he was just like talking, talking, talking.
Oh.
I think at the time I just didn't realize how remarkable it was because I literally didn't know anything. Were there any other spots that you wanted to talk about?
One place that I just really remember being important for me in the East Village was Mama's Food Shop. I don't know if you guys ever went there, but it was awesome. It was basically the East Village version of Meat and Three. It was a hot counter, and you could order fried chicken, meatloaf, a lot of the Southern classics, and it was on B, I believe, between B and A. And man, that place was like definitely affordable. You could order for like under $10. And then the other one was Barraquette, which I didn't personally go to a lot because I think I was likely going to San Loco, unfortunately. But that place it was around for almost 20 years. On Houston Street, right up from the Mercury Lounge. And really, what a cool sign from an era. And man, they tore that thing down and built a skyscraper or built a big office complex, whatever. So,
Jeez, yeah, New York.
do you have memories of those spots at all?
Barraquette, yes, a little bit. I remember having a good time there and good food. Yeah.
Yeah, Barraquette was good.
I mean, in the aughts, I was like such a broke child that like I always like going to those like free pizza bars.
Oh,
You know, you buy a
yeah.
drink
That
and
was
you
a
get like a
thing.
little personal pizza.
That was a thing. Brooklyn and in Manhattan,
Yeah,
both.
and I don't know if that's like a trend that is anywhere else, but do you know
I mean, the only place that comes to mind that maybe still does, is it even still open, Alligator Lounge? I don't even know.
On 14th?
No,
Oh, that was
wait,
Crocodile
that's
Lounge. There's one on the
Crocodile.
front.
Crocodile. Oh.
That was their other one. Alligator was in Brooklyn, right?
Yeah.
One I think maybe listeners will remember is Burritoville. Burritoville had 19 locations. I did a little research. 19 locations in New York at one point. Was in like basically doing like hippie mission style burritos. And now they only have one, I think, in Jersey City. But it is the Route 66 vegan burrito. That was my jam. I just have to shout that out.
I remember, and that is actually exactly what I ordered as well. For some reason, the one that comes to mind is the one that was in Chelsea,
Yeah. Oh,
like
yeah.
on 23rd, I guess.
Yeah.
I remember that one
Right by
better
the
than
movie
anything
theater.
else.
Yeah.
I don't like burritos, so I don't think I ever went there. They're too
Dude, I'm
big.
more ta I'm pro tacos personally. I don't know if that's where you're going
I
with
prefer
this.
tacos. Yeah, I just
Yeah.
can't. Burritos is like too much, and I don't like beans, so it doesn't work for me.
I have one to talk about, Plant Bar.
I never
Because
really went there.
I read Lizzie Goodman's book, and the James Murphy scenes where he's like playing to himself at Plant Bar. It's like right around the corner from where I live. I went there a little bit for like open bars and stuff, but I don't have like the strongest memory of Plant Bar being a thing. I know it was like the DFA place. I know you have one gin you want to talk about, which was Florent, right?
Oh, that was a 90s memory for me, like
Oh.
when I was in college and I wasn't like the college student who liked to hang out at college bars. I only wanted to hang out like in adult bars. And
Yeah.
so like there was one we found called Hell that was in the Meatpacking District, and 2 doors down it was Florent, which was like it's pretty well-known diner. I think like IFC even did like a documentary about it. It was like the cool place to hang out after drinking. So, and it was open late night, and
Yeah.
I always got the French fries, and I feel like people around me who ate escargot like would eat the escargot there.
My memory, it was extremely good. Like that, it was a high quality French brasserie in the
Yes.
Meatpacking District, which at the time was clearly not what it is today. It was mostly clubs,
Yeah.
and nightlife. And it was known amongst the artists and the kind of foodies of the time of downtown to go there at all hours for like extremely well executed French brasserie food, including those fries, which I remember being really good. And I think like Keith McNally is inspired by Florent, or in a way they go hand in hand probably. Him, his downtown brasseries in Florent, but I thought it was really it was a it's a, it's such an iconic place.
Yeah. I wish it was still around.
Right? But like there's like a Restoration Hardware there or something now, I'm sure.
Oh goodness.
Jeez.
The meatpacking is the worst neighborhood.
It's gotten worse through the years somehow.
It's gotten worse. It's truly the worst neighborhood.
I mean, yeah. I really liked going to that one bar, Hell, because it was like a really good mix of like gay and straight people. Mm. And it was like a little, you know, it had charm because it had all the celebrity photos with like the like Satan horns on them. And then like, I remember running into like Rufus Wainwright there. And then all these like dudes were like coming up to him, and my friends and I were like, who is this guy? So we were like kind of sitting across from him, and we like went up to him and were like, who are you? You must be somebody. Everyone's like, oh, coming up to you. And so he was like, oh, you know, my name is Rufus Wainwright. And we're like, are you famous? Like, and and then he was like, well, I was on the cover of Newsweek. And we were like, oh, okay, cool.
Oh my gosh. He cigarettes and chocolate milk is like was a one of my top five forever. What an incredible
the entire one. Poses album kind Poses. Of changed my life, honestly.
Me too. It's so, I mean, that's, it's such a remarkable, he's such a remarkable singer. His voice is one in a billion.
Doesn't surprise me that you saw him out, because like from everything I've heard, like he got around the block, and also like he was a party boy for a bit before he settled down, you know.
He writes about it on Poses quite a bit. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, obviously I figured out who he was after that, but like I was just like this young little college kid just like trying to act like I was an adult, so.
I want to end it with Sidewalk Cafe.
Okay.
Because I like lived right on that street for 3 years, and I never went there for the food ever. But I have to like shout out the quote unquote anti-folk movement and Moldy Peaches.
Of course.
Being really cool and really unique and an extremely small window of time. I think that that's the cool thing about anti-folk. It never really caught on, and it certainly isn't today isn't really vital or vibrant, but also produced some like Adam Green, like some really cool artists out of that scene, and I have to shout out Graham Smith too, Kleenex Girl Wonder, old friend of mine who used to play there all the time. So I think I went to his shows there quite a bit, and that dude Graham Smith is amazing.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, I always just remember going to see artists there. I think there were a lot of showcases and stuff there, and people just pass around the tip jar, and it was like this very like old school kind of free show, but tip the artist kind of thing.
Right.
And then maybe I go there for brunch on the weekend.
It's now a pretty cool cocktail bar, actually. They've kind of given it a little facelift. So the space looks nice since I went in January for an event, and it was nice, actually. Oh.
Shall we pop into Repeat Skip?
Let's do it.
Yay.
All right, so we're going to start off with the Spoon album, Kill the Moonlight, which was put out in 2002 on Merge.
You asked me to pick two albums, and like this one, to me, I picked two albums from 2002 that I think really capture that moment in time. Both are pretty piano-driven. We'll get into the second one later, but I think Kill the Moonlight, Girls Can Tell is my favorite Spoon album. It got me into Spoon, but this album in particular, I think production-wise and just the way Britt Daniel becomes the front man of that band and really just becomes this the Britt Daniel we know today was crystallized with this album. And, of course, Jim Eno, you have to shout out him, who's the producer of this album and all the Spoon material. And I think, I mean, this, I'll just, my caveat is skipping anything from this album is difficult for me. I will say that. I have a couple in mind.
Yeah, let's start with Repeats.
Small Stakes, the opening album song. You know, I have to say, like, having a White Stripes diss in your song is pretty epic. I think that's probably my favorite part of that song. And then, of course, The Way We Get By is the song that made it to the OC season 1, episode 5, where Seth and Ryan are at the Crab Shack. It's like this iconic scene. I love that one. And I'll just say Jonathan Fisk, I hope that we all share a love for Jonathan Fisk, which is this wonderful revenge song. written about a crappy metalhead in Britt Daniels' past. Those are a few of my favorites, but I have others that I could probably jump in on that I will repeat. Probably the whole album, actually. So.
This is a pretty good, like, album, like, as a whole. There's so much of it that really reminded me of, like, Elvis Costello and, like, a mix of Elvis and, like, Jeff Buckley, for, like, when he would get, like, all, like, wooey or whatever. In revisiting it, the song that really stood out for me was Something to Look Forward To, which I thought could be, like, a pandemic theme song.
Yeah, Matt, I agree with you. I mean, for me, Girls Can Tell is the stronger album on the whole. But I feel like with every Spoon album, there are very few misses. Like, it just, they always flow really beautifully. And I guess for me, if I had to pick a selection on this album, I would probably repeat The Way We Get By, just because I feel like that's just such a, like, a catchy tune. And yeah, I just remember putting it on, like, CDR mixes back in the day for people. But I remember actually kind of tying this into food. I remember once I was introduced to Britt Daniel at Enid's.
And
at the time I was like super into Spoon. And I just remember I was kind of frozen. Like, and he was the nicest guy. And I probably came across as this like really goofy, like blogger, awkward, whatever. But yeah, he was super nice. And I've heard like every story I've ever heard about Britt Daniel is just like he is like kind and easy to work with and like just like a gentleman.
I've heard as well. I have a friend who knows him from Austin, and yeah, he seems like a very generous human being, which is kind of rare. I have to say, all the Pretty Girls Go to the City, the keys, the piano arrangements, it's just like one of those songs that just stays with you. It's just like pure Kill the Moonlight right there. And the Elvis Costello I think You Got a Feeling is like the most Elvis Costello song to me on the album.
Yeah.
And it's such a great comparison. I agree fully. And, you know, Elvis Costello, I don't know if that's a reference that ages well with today's music listening youth. I don't know if Elvis Costello is that popular anymore.
Yeah.
I'm going to say probably not. So hopefully Britt Daniel will get people into Elvis Costello.
Yeah. That's their gateway.
Their gateway. Right. Exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
What was your skip? I know you can't pick one, but...
It's hard, and this is maybe polarizing, because Paper Tiger, I think I was reading some Pitchfork and from back in the day, and this was like their set piece. But I think Jimeno is brilliant, but to me, it gets a little too in the weeds with the production, but some will argue with me vehemently. Back to the Life 2 maybe is not the one I'd keep, but...
Yeah.
Sorry, Britt Daniel. I love the album. This is no offense to you.
My skip was Stay Don't Go, but I think it was just the beatboxing. I wasn't into it.
Fair enough.
He sings false. He goes up really high in that song, though, right?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, like, you know.
Sorry.
It's not a bad song. It's just maybe the one I would skip, like, if I was listening to it a lot.
Yeah,
I feel the same. I mean, there aren't too many, like absolute skips, but I guess I would maybe pick You Gotta Feel It, just because I don't know, I just feel like it's unnecessary in the album. Like, I would have been fine if it weren't there. But yeah, I mean, I always appreciate and enjoy every Spoon album. I mean, if to me, like, when Spoon puts out something, you know, you kind of know what you're getting, and in some ways it's just kind of, it's easy like that, you know. It's comfortable.
It's remarkable how long their career has been. I saw them at Prospect Park play maybe like 2 years ago, which was really fun to see them.
They played with Grizzly Bear.
That was a great show. I loved that show. And I got to say, late Spoon is getting better. It's hard to go against some of the early material. Girls Can Tell is clearly the magnum opus, I think we agree on. But man, this is a band that's getting better with age, which is kind of incredible in music to see that.
And they're going through a little bit of a nostalgia thing, too, because they have this, like, reissue campaign called Slay on Cue. So they're reissuing a bunch of their old releases. I guess it's the first time in a while that they've been reissued on vinyl, too. So, and that's all going through Matador. So that'll be cool that they get, you know, people can kind of rediscover them or, like, buy the vinyl. They didn't get it back in the day.
Yeah. I loved that Divine Fits album with the guy from Wolf Parade that Britt Daniel did.
Oh, that
was I wish they would get back that band back together. That was good stuff.
There were so many Wolf Parade offshoots.
Yeah, well, he's amazing.
There was another 2002 album we were going to talk about. Just totally different. Hot, Hot Heat, Make Up the Breakdown. That was on Sub Pop.
It was on Sub Pop, and like you asked me for a number two, and it was so hard. I mentioned Hearts of Oak would have been one. Maybe I picked maybe LCD Sound System's first album, but this one to me really captured the moment. I think I bought this at the Virgin store on CD, close to when it came out in 2002, and I remember seeing those massive, wall displays for this band. It was clearly a huge band for the label. It was such a contrast between the Spoon album, because like the frontman Steve Bays is also a Britt Daniel like frontman for this band. I mean, he really owned the stage. He really commanded, he was a commanding presence. And it's interesting, this album got an 8.7 and Kill the Moonlight got an 8.9. So if we're talking about, if we're litigating Pitchfork 2002, I mean, this is an interesting thing. I mean, I thought the album, just on reference, was pretty terrible.
Yeah.
And I wasn't really going to give it its fair shake. But then I went back and listened to some songs and actually have a little bit of a different memory now. I don't know if you share that opinion.
I mean.
Well, I have to say that I was very into this album when it came out. And I actually forgot that Sub Pop put it out. I would have thought it was like RCA or something. But I mean, I haven't listened to it probably since like very shortly after it was released. So it was a trip going back to it. And I think so much of it is cringy for me that like his vocals and also the lyrics and also just like, it just seemed like they were trying so hard to be seven different things, you know, like a little Iggy, a little Stooges, a little like dance punk, like Chick Chick Chick-esque, like they were going in all these directions, and you could tell it was, I don't know, it was a little all over the place.
And there were some songs, like the one I picked for repeat, Oh No Not Now, that was actually okay. Like, I didn't actually mind that too much, but there are so many songs like that I just was like, ugh.
Speaking of the vocal address, I got a lot of Dismemberment Plan from this band. I think Dismemberment Plan is one of these bands that when you get to some of the albums, the vocals, even though the frontman has great vocals and can sing in an incredible range, it can be very disturbing. And I just saw the way the keyboard is working here, the electric, you know, the plugged in keyboards are really straining at times. I agree with you that there's a lot of misses here. But I think there are a few ones that I would put on a mixtape today. I would say so.
Yeah, which ones?
I mean, come on, Bandages on My Legs and My Arms for You. I mean, come
on. I mean, that's a clap. That was their hit.
That's a great single.
You know?
It's a great single. It's on mixtapes. It's probably played in stores while people are folding clothes today, to this day.
Yeah.
I mean, Naked in the City, No Not Now, as a movement, is pretty fun. For me, it scratches that faint itch a little bit, which I find truly unlistenable to this day. I stand.
I'm laughing because like I was really into the faint when I was in college, and me too. And like I cannot listen to it.
Oh,
now.
I stand so hard for the faint. Blink Wave Arcade was on all the time on my radio show, and like, man, what an unlistenable band. No offense, Faint. I'm sorry, guys, but they were like going there with these first two songs in some of that way. So. I think, but those are keepers to me, you know?
Yeah.
So. Jen, what would you keep?
Oh, well, I said...
Oh, you said No Not Now. Is there anything else, or that's it, pretty much?
Well, I mean, yeah, I would be basic as well and say Bandages, but, like, yeah, I don't know. That would be my basic choice, just because, like, if I was at a dance party and that came on, like say we had a Knots party or something like that, like... I would definitely be like, holy shit. you know?
Yeah, if I heard this and it was like particularly a throwback event, I would freak out if I heard Bandages, I'm not going to lie.
It's a good deep cut.
I chose the song with the most cowbell on the album, Talk to Me, Dance with Me, which yeah. I don't know why. Like, I think all of these songs, like, I have memories of just because, like, I saw this band so many times around the time of the album release. And I just remember dancing to that. But yeah, I saw them for the first time at 9:30 Club shortly after the album was released. And I went with this this guy I had a crush on who was as straight as an arrow. I just remember like dancing with him, and we were doing all the bro stuff where like your arm is around the other guy's like shoulder. Mm-hmm. I was like, it's gonna happen. It never happened. And then they Hot, he played Siren Festival one year where Idlewild headlined, who I was super into. And then that same friend, the straight boy, came back to like stay with me in 2003. I was like, it's going to happen now. It didn't happen then either.
Oh boy.
But it's funny. I have these memories, but it's kind of funny how a lot of times this, you know, I mean, this is just human nature. The song is attached to a specific place, a specific person, a specific mm-hmm. time in your life, a mm-hmm. specific venue. And, this album very much so for me.
Yeah. I skipped Oh God Damn It because like that Strokes ripoff is so bad. It's so bad that, and it's stylistically pre-divorced from the rest of the album. And I have to say Save Us SOS, like that I heard a tick-tock ring ring. Like it's like bad like high school theater like workshopping when you're like it's like I can see him like looking at his watch when he's singing the song. Like I don't know if there's it's just like a very bad lyrical exchange there. Sorry, Steve Bays.
Probably none of these lyrics make too much sense. No. You know? Like I was like, oh no, she's not a secret now, but nobody cares. Like I have no idea what he means by that.
But that song really hits though, man.
Yeah, it does.
I mean, it's such an era. Yeah.
Matt, what was your skip?
There were quite a few skips, but I think my least favorite on this album is This Town.
Yeah.
That was mine too.
They really go up a range with the keyboard. I mean, they really like start climbing the stairs, and it goes somewhere. It goes like to hell, basically.
It's kind of like a terrible Ben Folds B side or something. Yeah. I don't like it.
I had Steve Bay's number in my phone, and I found it like 10 years ago. And my friend Steve Rydell of Hood Internet, he jokes me, cracks me all the time about Steve Bays, and we actually joke about calling him, which I won't do unless he wants to call me. Steve, call me if you have my phone number. I don't know how it ended up there. It was probably from an interview that I long forgot.
Yeah, because this is one of those bands who are like, okay, we're done now in like 2016. And everyone was like, we thought you were done a long time ago.
Yeah, I saw that on the website, and look, the promo photos were looking really good. Like they were looking healthy, these guys.
I actually saw them a few years after this album came out, but I don't remember the show whatsoever. They opened for Editors at Terminal 5. Yeah. But for some reason I completely blanked it out of my head. I think I was just so over this album after like, you know, summer of 2003.
Yeah. What great album art and colorways, though. Gotta say, mm-hmm, for mm-hmm. me, that was really strong. But, yeah. Can I shout out one album that I was thinking a lot about this era that means a lot to me? Yeah. Is Exploding Hearts album, their debut. They had an EP, and I just like this is a band that I debated pitching it for this segment, but it's such a sad story that the three of the four members died in a car accident. Literally coming back from a showcase in San Francisco. They were based in Portland, I believe Portland or Seattle. I think it's Portland. And that band, they were going to hit. They were really poised to be a big thing. And they reminded me a lot of Waves, the way Waves kind of took over and became this whole thing, this like punk, but with like a real like instrumentation and vocal sensibility that was cool. And like it's just such a sad story, but I still listen to that. It holds up so well. So I just had to in this podcast to your listeners, just Exploding Hearts. I just love them, and I used to DJ them a lot. And one time I had played one of the songs at Motor City, and I played it, and this woman comes up to the booth and just really she literally starts crying and said, "These are my friends. Thank you for playing it." It was really crazy to have that happen. And just like I think of this era, I think of Exploding Hearts and what could have been. That band.
That's such a sad story.
It's a sad story. I know. It's a real, real sad one.
Yeah, I'm always sad when something like that happens just out of the blue, and or like maybe they rise too fast and then like get caught up in things and something happens. Mm-hmm. Those are like the stories that really get me just like out of nowhere. I just remember, like, yeah, I don't know.
Which one? Yeah, go for it. You have a memory.
Yeah, well, you know, this guy that I knew, Jerry, he was in a bunch of bands, drummer. you know, drummers, like they're always in multiple bands because everyone needs a good drummer and there's not that many. And then I think at this time he was in Chick Chick Chick, and then he like died. He like fell down an elevator shaft at a party or something like that. You know, like when there's party in those old buildings.
He was in Turing Machine too, right?
Yeah.
Turing Machine, yeah.
He was in so many bands, but he was also in a band that I managed at one point. He was in Knife Skills. It just shocks you. Anyway,
Yeah, that's great.
not to be such a downer.
No. It's a memory. It's a mixtape memories. The part
Yeah.
about this show is some, what makes your show so great is just bringing memories from this really important era
Yeah.
in the New York music scene that you cover so well and we're part of. So,
Yeah. Well, thanks so
yeah.
much for
Thank you.
being
Yes,
part
thank you.
of our new season.
Really appreciate it. I love your show.
Thanks so much to Matt for joining us for this great episode, looking back on food and music.
So great. I
So
loved it.
good. And we will catch you next time on another episode of
Mixtape
Mixtape Memories.
Memories.
Bye.
Bye.